exploding Range Rover's privatized fish, and of course, Bjork. That's what reporter Michael Lewis found on a reporting trip to Iceland, all part of his effort to report on Iceland's startling rise and precipitous economic collapse. The collapse was so complete and so sudden that today the Icelandic currency is close to valueless, and the nation's debt is nearly 10 times its GDP. Michael Lewis writes his trip about his trip in his article, Frozen Assets, in the April issue of Vanity Fair. And we want to hear from those of you who may have been to Iceland or have some experience with the economy there. What was your impression? Tell us your story, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Michael Lewis is a contributing editor to Vanity Fair magazine and author of Frozen Assets, and he joins us today from a studio in Berkeley, California. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thanks, Neil. Nice to be here.
And that first thing that tipped you off was the sound in the otherwise quiet Icelandic night of detonating Land Rovers.
I had just arrived, and there were all these weird noises in my hotel room that were keeping me up in the middle of the night. And the last of them were these explosions. And I got out of my bed the next morning and I went to interview a young banker. And I said, it was a little odd. There were all these noises and these explosions. And he said, yep, there have been reports of lots of Range Rovers blowing up. And he kind of laughed about it. But what he meant was, and what had happened was, during the boom years, 2003 to 2008 in Iceland, Icelanders had taken to, because their own currency, the krona, had a very high rate of interest associated with it. If you borrowed krona to buy a Range Rover, you paid a 16% interest rate. So they all borrowed Swiss franc and Japanese yen and other currencies to buy these, to buy houses, to buy Range Rovers. And when the banks collapsed last fall and winter, and the Icelandic krona collapsed, they found themselves owing huge sums of money in krona terms for these things they'd bought. And there were really only one or two things you could do to get out of your car loan. One was to put the car on a boat and ship it to Europe and try to sell it for some currency that was worth something. Or the other thing was to set it on fire and hand it back to the insurance company. And so that's what the young banker was referring to when he said there'd been a lot of reports of Range Rovers blowing up.
And take us through this. It all began Iceland, a relatively well-educated, very well-educated.
Extremely well-educated.
And prosperous nation there in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean that had for hundreds of years survived, nicely, by fishing.
Yes. Well, first, let's put this in perspective. We're talking about a nation of 300,000 people, which is less than the population of Peoria, Illinois. And Peoria, Illinois doesn't have its own currency, and it doesn't have any multinational banks or hedge funds. And Iceland got all these things. What happened was they privatized their banks 2001, 2002, and they really started to grow in 2003. And their growth was really amazing. I mean, it was the, as one economist put it to me, it was the most rapid expansion of a banking system in the history of the world. They went from having a few billion dollars of assets on their books in 2003 to, in 2008, when they collapsed, having $140 billion in assets on their books. And you know, nobody's presented me with a totally convincing accounting of the losses, but the estimates are that there are about $100 billion of losses in these banks.
For Peoria, Illinois.
Yeah, so think about that. That's roughly 330 grand for every man, woman, and child in Iceland. And the question is, how did this happen?
And the other question you ask is, how did a nation of North Atlantic fishermen decide that they could out Wall Street, Wall Street?
Ah, well, that's a really good question. Maybe the first way to answer that is to ask why do they even want to do it in the first place? And I think the answer is that Iceland had been very cleverly run up until they discovered investment banking. What they figured out in the early 70s, their economy is basically built on fishing. They have these wonderful fishing grounds, mainly, their main export is cod, and they have rights to 300 miles, very generous rights to their fishing waters. But historically, fishermen are poor. It's an odd thing. I mean, fishing villages around the world are poor, and the reason is that fishermen fish to the point where fishing isn't profitable. And what Iceland did in the early 70s is they essentially privatized the fish. They created a cartel. They said, "We're going to give you Fisherman Joe the rights to X percent of the cod that are caught every year from our waters, and we will determine what the right amount of cod is overall."
So they don't overfish, and so the stocks replenish.
They don't overfish, and they don't spend more time than they have to getting the fish that they do fish, and they have essentially a monopoly-like profits on the fish. And this created essentially a boom in Iceland. It created overnight billionaires in Iceland and real wealth. And Iceland has been very good at turning their wealth into human capital, which is to say that they've invested very heavily in education. It's normal for an Icelandic kid he has his education paid for all the way through graduate school. His year abroad or any study abroad is paid for. And you have this nation of people who are wonderfully cultivated.
Yet PhDs generally don't go fishing.
That's the problem, that they created a wonderfully cultivated population that had basically two horrible ways to make a living. One was trawler fishing, and two is the newest is aluminum smelting. There's a long historical explanation for why aluminum smelting has happened in Iceland. But in any case, so when presented with investment banking as an alternative, I think a number of them just said eureka. And in fact, an awful lot of fishermen stopped fishing and became bankers overnight. Now, the wonder is that the world enabled this and that banks from all over the world were willing to supply Icelandic banks with loans. I mean, that these $140 billion in assets these banks had came from somewhere, and they came from, you know, German banks lending them $25 billion and Danish banks lending them many billions of dollars and UK depositors putting money into Icelandic banks. But in any case, for whatever reason, the world enabled these people to go off on this spree. And Iceland briefly tried to transform itself into essentially a world financial capital.
We're talking with Michael Lewis, the author of Frozen Assets, about Iceland's precipitous rise and even more precipitous decline as a result of the financial crisis in this month's issue, or April's issue of Vanity Fair magazine. And let's get a caller on the line. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, email talk@npr.org. And Kirsten is with us. Kirsten calling from Stanford.
Hi, I just called because I actually traveled to Iceland back in 2007,
mm-hmm.
and it was actually the most extraordinarily expensive place I had ever been in my entire life.
Give us an example, Kirsten.
I stayed at a very small hotel. I booked it online, and I knew it was going to be small. When I arrived, they said that the price was actually going to be $80 more than I expected. And when I got to my room, it was so small I couldn't even open my suitcase. food, I went to a vegan cafe where you actually pick the food yourself. And I just got a bowl of soup, some kind of fruit drink, and a piece of banana bread, and that was about $35.
Wow.
It was really, it was a beautiful place, but the people I spoke to said that they usually would take up two jobs just to pay for everyday expenses. So I had a feeling that, you know, maybe that wouldn't be sustained much longer.
Well, Michael Lewis, she's talking about the height of the boom there.
She is talking about the height of the boom. A period in which Icelanders had borrowed huge sums of money to buy things in Iceland, so driving the price of everything up. I mean, what intrigued me about the place was that it was first an example of American kind of business intellectual influence gone wrong, but second, it was a more extreme version of what we're going through here. And the in the boom, which was all about leverage, all about people buying things with borrowed money. The Icelandic stock market went up 9 times. The property market tripled. The wealth in the place went through the roof, and so it did become. I'm sure I didn't travel there when it was expensive, but I'm sure it was very expensive for someone coming from outside to go to visit.
Kirsten, would you go back? I suspect things are a lot cheaper now.
Yeah, I mean, the reason actually I made my trip so short, I actually ended up going to Copenhagen quickly afterwards because I couldn't afford all of the prices there. But I would love to go back. And one other funny anecdote, I drove out to the middle of nowhere to a hot springs, and the only cars there were giant Hummers. And the price of gas at that point, I think, was probably $15 a gallon. So it was a little funny, I'd have to say.
Okay, Kirsten, thanks very much for the call. Michael Lewis was talking earlier about how Iceland has been so clever in the past. For example, it's an important member of NATO, and its contribution is its geography. It has no armed forces whatsoever. It's protected by the other members of NATO, and its geography is it sits in the middle of the shipping routes of the North Atlantic and the center of the so-called Geuk Gap that blocks the exits into the North Atlantic. Well, that's enough for NATO to consider it a very valuable member of the alliance, and there's an airbase there, too, and some other things, but no Icelandic soldiers. We're talking about Michael Lewis's article, Frozen Assets, in the April issue of Vanity Fair magazine. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's see if we can go now to Richard. Richard's calling us from Kalamazoo.
Hi, Neil.
Hi, Richard.
I was here about almost 10 years ago, and to kind of concur with the previous caller, it was very beautiful. It was a nice little excursion. But I was eating at an Indian restaurant one night, and the owner came over, and we started talking, and she had a home in North Carolina. She was Indian. And I said, well, what are you doing in Reykjavik? And she said, well, I have this restaurant, and my kids go to school here. And I said, really? And I said, why, you know, Iceland? She said, well, you know, it's so safe here. There's no crime. When I leave for work and my kids go off to school, I don't even lock the doors. And I thought that was really interesting. I thought, you know, hey, here's a nice idyllic place that you can, you know, live and not worry about anybody breaking in. So I know recently they've had problems with, you know, some violence over there.
It's one of the things, Michael Lewis, you write about.
What do I write about? Violence?
Yeah, about that different sense of security. Because people are putting money in their mattresses.
Well, yes, that when the banks collapsed, I spent some time with one young banker who saw it was all going to come a cropper, thought that the local currency was going to be worth nothing, and he, like a number of other clever people, went and took as many dollars and yen and Swiss francs and euros and other currencies out of the banks, and he took them home and he hid them in a board game. But people were hoarding food, and people were concerned. He had a very odd concern. He was so unused to having large amounts of cash on him because the whole place functions with credit cards. People pay for the most trivial transactions with their credit cards. That he was sure that once he had this huge sack of cash, he was bound to be mugged. And he kept going on and on about how he assumed that plane loads of muggers were coming over from New York to take his money. And so he didn't want – in fact, he wouldn't let us put his picture in Vanity Fair because he was afraid someone would connect him to the board game full of cash and his home would be robbed. But I'm not sure there's a huge amount of crime. I mean, their social problems are trivial compared to most countries. It's what's happened there is more of an identity crisis. I mean, they're technically bankrupt. They owe people all kinds of money. I'm not sure they're ever going to repay it. But it's much more this vast social embarrassment. They thought they were really good at being investment bankers. They thought that they had this incredibly slick operation up and running, and they thought they were, you know, all of a sudden there were all these young millionaires wandering around. A man from the IMF told me when he went in there to try to sort out the mess, he said, it's the most incredible thing I've ever seen. He said, it's not a country. Iceland is not a country. It's a hedge fund, and it's a hedge fund that's collapsed. He said, there are all these young people who dressed in black and just started doing trades. And now they've realized they're coming to grips with the idea that they weren't so good at this, and this wasn't such a good idea. And so there are protests in the streets. There's some trivial violence between police and protesters, or has been. The government's stepped down and been replaced, but Iceland is not a dangerous place. I mean, the most dangerous thing that's going to happen to you in Iceland is you're going to drive out into the country and get lost.
The other aspect of this that I found truly fascinating was the division of the sexes on this. That the all of this boom was fueled by men.
Yes, this was you know, when I got there, I was surprised to find lots of things about the place surprised me because I'd never been there before. One was, all right, it's a nation of 300,000 people. It's Peoria, Illinois, but it's got four major political parties. Now, you know, that suggests either like a talent for disagreement or just nobody's listening to each other. And there's even some minor political parties. So think about that. All right. I don't know how many people are in each party and you've got to discount the children. But anyway, so one of these political parties that had been in power basically throughout this whole mess and before and it arranged to privatize the banks, the Independence Party, is a party almost entirely of men. It's a fisherman's party, and the men had vast confidence in their abilities to triumph in a global financial system, and the men were behind all of the big moves that happened in the banks, in the government, and now that it's all come a cropper, the women are taking over. The women are basically sussing out that the men completely screwed up. And the party that's come into power is the Social Democrats. Their leader is a woman, a lesbian, the first openly gay head of state in the world. And, you know, her first acts are, among other things, ban strip clubs. But the women have walked in and said, you know, no more. This financial disaster was at bottom all about mail over confidence, and we're going to put an end to it.
And you can read all about it in the April issue of Vanity Fair magazine. The article is called Frozen Assets. Michael Lewis is its author. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Tomorrow, it's Science Friday. Ira Flatow will be here with a discussion with theoretical physicist Lisa Randall, plus a talk with chemist Harry Kroto about his discovery of buckyballs. That's all tomorrow on Science Friday. I'll be off for a few days, back on Thursday for Talk of the World. Meantime, Allison Stewart will be here. Have a great weekend, everybody. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.